Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to First Thursday. This is Labor Relations Information Systems podcast on recent developments in public safety labor relations. My name is Will Aitchison, and for the next 45 minutes or so, I'll be your host, and we'll go over a number of things that have happened over the course of the last month that have some bearing on the public safety workplace, the workplace of firefighters, police officers, correctional officers, and employees who have similar public safety duties. I want to start this time by talking about a recent drug testing case. I know drug testing hasn't been the subject of an awful lot of litigation lately, but I'm starting to see an uptick in news stories about random drug testing. For example, there was a story I read this morning that dealt with a Florida agency's, a sheriff's department's desire to increase the frequency of drug testing of employees who worked in a jail. And the sheriff's comment was, even though we have random drug testing, we're just not doing it enough to catch as many people as we should catch. And that made me think maybe we all need sort of a primer on the whole issue of random drug testing. Maybe go back to the start and look at it. And thankfully, there's a recent case. This is a case that comes out of a federal court of appeals, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And this one also involves corrections officers. And I think it really sets the stage pretty well for four separate points that I want to make about random drug testing. First of all, very briefly, the facts of what's going on in the case, and then we'll get to the four separate points. This is a case involving a lieutenant. His name is Roderick Washington, who was employed in the juvenile detention center in Wyandotte County, which is in Kansas City, Kansas. And yes, for those of you in Kansas, I realize that almost inevitably I have mispronounced Wyandotte County. I'm just doing my best, and I challenge you all to come out to Oregon and pronounce something like Willamette River. So, with that disclaimer, Washington is subject to random drug testing, as are all corrections officers. He tests positive for cocaine, and he is fired. He then files a civil rights lawsuit against the county and several of his supervisors, alleging that the drug test was an illegal search that violated the 4th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. The 4th Amendment, of course, being the search and seizure provision of the Constitution, and the 14th Amendment being the amendment that applies the 4th Amendment to states and local governmental bodies. And basically what he's saying is random drug testing doesn't comport with the search and seizure requirements of the 4th Amendment. You need a warrant. You need probable cause. And random drug testing won't cut it. So this poses the 10th Circuit with what I think of as the first point that I want to make in discussing the whole issue of random testing, which is, where are the federal courts with respect to random drug testing of public safety employees? Well, first sub-point to that is the U.S. Supreme Court has never considered the issue. It came close a number of years ago, came close in some cases involving customs employees who were, at least then, members of the National Treasury Employees Union. But that wasn't random testing. That was testing that was associated with the promotional process. And so, arguably, you have very different constitutional interests in mind. The Supreme Court, however, did approve that testing in the NTEU cases, in the customs cases. And what that did was to set the table for any number of lower federal courts to decide whether or not random drug testing violates the 4th Amendment to the Constitution. And at least for law enforcement officers, I think the decisions are unanimous, and that is random testing does not violate the search and seizure provisions of the 4th Amendment. I don't know of a case to the contrary. I know of one firefighter case to the contrary, but there's a bunch of them that hold that firefighters are no different than law enforcement officers, no different than police officers or corrections officers, and that firefighters can be randomly tested as well. So point number one that I want to make is there doesn't appear to be anything in the federal constitution that courts think violate the Fourth Amendment about random testing. How do they analyze these cases? Well, I think the Tenth Circuit's opinion in this Wyandotte County case is really a model for how courts take a look at these things. The court starts off by saying, ordinarily, of course, the Fourth Amendment requires individualized suspicion. In other words, it requires probable cause in order for a search to be reasonable. But the court says there is an exception to that. And that exception is what we call the special need exception. And in those cases, which aren't involved in particular investigations of criminality, those cases that go beyond, as the court says, ordinary crime detection, we will allow suspicionless drug testing if the government's interest outweigh the individual's privacy interests. Okay, so that's a multi-part test, right? Is there a special need? And if there is a special need, what's the government's interest in random testing? And what's the privacy interest of, in this case, a corrections officer in random testing? The court says, first of all, yeah, there's a special need. And there can be a special need even in the absence of an articulable drug problem among employees. And in this case, the county has a special need. And what is the special need? It's the need to ensure the safety and welfare of children who are housed in the juvenile detention center. And the way the court puts it in this case is, and this is a quote, the county serves as a guardian to juveniles residing at the center and has a significant interest in ensuring the safety of those under its full-time care, many of whom have struggled with substance abuse. By preventing drug use among its employees who have interaction with and access to residents, the county ensures that interaction with the youth are handled by non-impaired individuals. So there is a special need. Now let's pause for a moment. There's an assumption there, right? Isn't the assumption there that drug testing prevents drug use among employees? Isn't that at the heart of the notion that there is a special need? Let's come back to that assumption in a couple moments. Okay, so the court says there is a special need, so now we're going to balance. We're going to balance the needs of the employer against the privacy interests of the employee, and well, let's look first of all at the privacy interests of Washington. And the court says he doesn't have much. He has a diminished expectation of privacy because he works in a prison. All prison employees have a diminished expectation of privacy. And in any case, the drug test was what the court refers to as minimally invasive. Washington provided the urine sample in a restroom with the door closed without a monitor. So we find a minimal invasion of his privacy by forcing him to urinate. Now, what about the governmental interest? The court says that's a high governmental interest here. And there's two of them. And I'll quote from the court's opinion again. The first involves the unique situation of working with juveniles in an educational setting when an employee has an in loco parentis custodial and educational relationship with minors, especially at-risk minors. That employee's illegal drug use presents a risk of harm to the minors. That's one interest that's high enough to override Washington's privacy rights. The second is that this is a law enforcement employee who has direct contact with inmates, and that employee's illegal drug use can pose a significant threat to inmates and the security of the facility. So overall, what we've got here is an identified special need, minimal privacy interests, and overriding interests on the part of the employer in a drug-free workplace, particularly in this juvenile corrections setting. Therefore, the drug test is constitutional. All right, that's how federal courts typically will examine these sorts of things. That's point number one. Point number two is, are they right? Does random testing really reduce drug use? And if you actually look at the evidence on this, rather than have these sort of highfalutin statements you read from the courts, you're going to find the answer is, yeah, but there's better systems, more effective systems of controlling drug use among employees. There are a number of studies that show that by far the most effective way of controlling drug use among public safety employees is training supervisors and empowering them to intervene with at-risk employees. That catches far more people who are using drugs than drug testing does. But, you know, often in the courts, it's the idea that matters more than the actual facts. And to be sure, random testing does catch some employees. And I think the courts, to the extent they would ever analyze this issue, might say, hey, you know, even if there are better systems out there, drug testing actually works. By the way, what's the evidence say about what the cheapest way is to control drug use among employees? Once again, it's training supervisors and empowering them. It's not drug testing. But that's another issue. Okay, so point number two is in fact, drug testing, random drug testing, does work in the sense that it does reduce drug use by employees. It pretty clearly isn't the most effective way of doing that. Third, I've been talking about federal law and federal constitutional law. We have 50 state constitutions out there, and state constitutions can grant more in the way of constitutional rights to the residents of those states than does federal law. Many of you who are in law enforcement have seen that your whole careers, where your state Supreme Court has erected an entirely different set of rules with respect to search and seizure and other rights of criminal suspects than would be in place in the federal system. And the whole notion is, states can give their citizens more, not less, more constitutional rights than the federal constitution gives all of us. And that principle has been applied in drug testing. The first place that it was applied was by the Massachusetts Supreme Court, which struck down the Boston Police Department's mandatory drug testing program that used urinalysis. Struck it down on the basis that it violated the Massachusetts Constitution, that you could not have drug testing under the Massachusetts Constitution. Then a number of years after that, I had the same case up in Alaska when we had a new mayor who was elected. And those of you who've been doing this long enough know that when you hear that phrase, a new mayor has been elected, it maybe should send a few shivers up your spine. Well, one of the things this new mayor did was to adopt a random drug testing program. And that issue, for both police and fire, that issue went to the Alaska Supreme Court, which said, you know, our Constitution grants more rights to our citizens than the federal Constitution. You can't have suspicionless drug testing of police and fire, at least in the absence of a demonstrable drug problem among the employees. And then the Arizona Supreme Court went the same way in a case involving firefighters in the city of Mesa, Arizona. I think that case was called Peterson versus City of Mesa. So you do have some state constitutions that prohibit random drug testing, even though the federal constitution allows it. So that's my third point. My fourth point is, without regard to whether or not drug testing is constitutionally permitted or prohibited, it is clear that drug testing is a mandatory subject of bargaining. Random drug testing is a mandatory subject of bargaining. Reasonable suspicion testing, oddly, turns out not to be. The imposition of a random drug testing program and the protocols that are used in that program, what drugs are tested for, what the thresholds are for a positive test, what a confirmatory test looks like, how you split samples, whether or not the sample is given in privacy, the 1001 details of a drug testing program, those are thought to be mandatory for bargaining, not because of the impact on employee privacy, but also because of the potential disciplinary ramifications of the drug testing program. So let's sum up now on drug testing. Random drug testing, the federal courts say, does not violate the federal constitution. Point one. Point two, random drug testing does reduce illegal drug use by employees, but it is not the most effective manner of doing so, nor is it the cheapest manner. Third, where random drug testing does not violate the federal constitution, it may, depending upon how your state Supreme Court has construed your state constitution, violate your state constitution. It may. And fourth, a random drug testing program is mandatory for bargaining, which means if an employer wants to implement one or wants to substantially change one, it has to negotiate with whatever union is on the scene. So there we have it, drug testing 101. I want to spend a moment now kind of teasing you about some things that will be coming up in our March 2017 newsletter, Public Safety Labor News. As I mentioned the other month, we can't cover everything in these podcasts that we put in the newsletter. It's just impossible. There's usually about 18 articles in each of the newsletters, and I only have time to talk about three or four of those topics, and sometimes even those don't overlap in these podcasts. There's some interesting stuff, though, in the newsletter that you might want to check out. For example, in the collective bargaining section where we talk about settlements, we have a description of that whopper of a San Jose police settlement. And this is a settlement that is basically a 3.5-year contract that calls for a 20% raise over the course of 3.5 years. And that's a pretty amazing raise. San Jose, of course, the police department have been completely racked by a turnover problem, a retention and a recruitment problem. Was down essentially about 600 officers from where it was 5 years or so ago. And it didn't start with all that many officers. It started with around 1,400 officers. They were down 600. And finally, the city council has decided that they really need to fix this problem, that there are serious public safety implications with the turnover problem and the recruitment problem. And so one thing that they're doing is entering into this long-term contract that will bring some measure of stability with the Police Officers Association. Also, there have been rollbacks, voter-induced rollbacks, of some of the most onerous of the reductions in pension benefits. So things are looking a little bit brighter. So we have a description of that settlement. By the way, the San Jose Police debacle that went on for years, I think one of the most poignant points in the whole what are we going to do now problem was when staffing got so low that for a moment the city talked about ending all specialty assignments. It never quite got that far. But what it did was to have enough mandatory overtime that some officers were parking their RVs in the parking lot of the police department because they simply didn't have time to go home. Most San Jose officers don't get paid enough to afford to be able to live in the city, so they live quite some distances away. And if you're working 14, 16, 18 hours a day and you have an RV, Maybe you don't want to go home. Maybe you just want to park it in the police department parking lot. Anyway, that made for quite the headlines. And I think really had an element in pushing the city towards a settlement. There's some other big settlements that are out there that we chronicle in our contracts in the news section. In Raleigh, North Carolina, this actually isn't a contract settlement because there's not collective bargaining in North Carolina. But there's a 13.25% raise in Raleigh, North Carolina. And in Boston, you just settled a four-year contract. They just settled one last week with 4 2% raises, plus a fair amount of additional money in the contract in different places. In Boston, it takes the form of an educational incentive that is known as the Quinn Bill, referring to the name of a bill at the state legislature that established this educational incentive program. And the question ever since then has been, how do you fund it, who pays for it, and everything like that. Well, in addition to the 8%, the city has agreed to pay far more of its responsibilities under the Quinn Bill. So we've got a bunch of different settlements out there. I want to return to San Jose for just a moment to talk about one feature of that settlement. And it's a feature we're seeing increasingly, in particular, in police settlements. And that is, money is being put into elements of the total compensation structure other than wages. You might think of it, if you're not in a particularly good mood at the moment, as hiding money in other elements of the total compensation structure. What it does is to take an employer off the hook from having to match police wage increases with other bargaining units with which it deals. And that's become increasingly important for a number of large employers as they find that they are having a devil of a time recruiting and retaining police officers, but not such a hard time recruiting and retaining other employee groups. And what any rational employer does, kind of economics 101 in those situations, is they'll increase the wages for the groups they're having a hard time recruiting and retaining. But then, on the other hand, they've got the other unions knocking on their door saying, me too, why aren't you giving us the same wage increase? And so what employers in that situation have done, and unions have been willing participants in this, is to put money into other elements of the total compensation structure. And what they did in San Jose, I said that was 20% over 3.5 years. Well, part of that 20% is in a new form of specialty pay. And it is specialty pay for employees who either take or sign up to take crisis intervention training. They will get 2.75% for doing that in fiscal year 2018, and by fiscal year 2019, they'll get an additional 1%. So it'll top out at 3.75%. What do you anticipate? About what percentage of that bargaining unit may end up with 3.75% crisis intervention training pay? I tend to think that that's going to be about 100% of the bargaining unit. Looks from afar like a nothing more than a disguised form of a wage increase. So at any rate, we detail those and other settlements in the newsletter. There's also an article I'm not going to talk about in the podcast, but it's a fascinating one that details a federal court decision allowing officers involved in the Freddie Gray case to bring a malicious prosecution lawsuit against Marilyn Mosby, the DA in Baltimore County. And it's a fascinating case. I commend you to either reading the case or reading the discussion of it in the newsletter, because it's one of the few cases where you actually see the defense of prosecutorial immunity pierced. And in this case, pierced by officers who are claiming that they were wrongfully prosecuted without probable cause and based essentially on a political agenda rather than a prosecutorial agenda. Well, that's it for the March edition of the newsletter. Now let's get back to the podcast. Now let's talk about last chance agreements. I don't think I've ever addressed these things in the podcasts. And a recent case out of Illinois tells me that it's essentially time that we have a bit of a conversation about last chance agreements. What is a last chance agreement? Typically, this is where you have an employee who is screwing up by the numbers one way or another. Often, these sorts of cases involve alcohol-related misconduct, though not always. Eventually, the employee does something that warrants termination, but the employer isn't quite sure that it's ready to terminate the employee. So what it does is to offer the employee a last chance at their job. And so there's an agreement that is entered into between the employee and the employer, and the agreement says something like, instead of being fired this time, I agree to accept a whatever, 30-day suspension. I'm going to undergo retraining or perhaps alcohol rehabilitation treatment. And if I mess up in the same way within X number of years, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, whatever it might be, you can fire me and I won't have access to the grievance procedure. That's a last chance agreement. You see them called other things. Sometimes they're called a return to work agreement. Now, various nomenclature is used, but the heart of all of them is that the employee has a last chance. One thing before I dive into this Illinois case that I want to talk about with respect to last chance agreements is these sorts of agreements involve a negotiable topic, right? They involve discipline. And that means the agreement has to be with the union. It can't just be with the employee. There's a principle of labor law that any agreement concerning a mandatory subject of bargaining has to be with the labor organization. Put it another way, the law demands that an employer refrain from going employee by employee and having individual negotiations with those employees about anything that's mandatory for bargaining, wages, hours, or working conditions. That's thought to undercut the union's ability to act as the exclusive bargaining representative for employees. So those sorts of contracts, sometimes they're called yellow dog contracts, are illegal. What is an employer to do? When the employer wants to offer a last chance agreement to employees, the best thing it can do is get the union involved at that point. I will tell you, having represented unions in these last chance situations many, many times, I will tell you that the union is often, usually, the employer's best friend in dealing with the employee. There's an element of peer pressure that the union can bring when it looks at the employee and says, hey, our job is to represent you. We are your peers. And we think the employer has the ability to fire you for whatever you've just done. And a last chance agreement is by far in your best interest. I think I've seen just so many times there's a tremendous value to the union doing that. So not only is it legally required that the employer bring the union into the last chance discussions with the employee, and if I was an employer, I'd always want the union to sign off to make sure that the union's participation is documented. Not only is there a legal requirement, it also really helps. It helps turn around troubled employees. Okay, so that's our backdrop. What's going on in this Illinois case? It's an odd case factually because we have the same employee not on one last chance agreement, but two. And the employee is a police officer by the name of Tom Olson for the village of Fox Lake, Illinois. He was first fired by the village in 2013 for a variety of offenses that included things like insubordination, failing to properly and appropriately complete reports, and also, just for good measure, harassing a village resident. And at the time that he was fired in 2013, he actually was on an earlier last chance agreement, one that was reached in 2007. What did he do in 2007? He had engaged in inappropriate conduct during a traffic stop. So when he's fired in 2013, what the village is actually doing is invoking the 2007 Last Chance Agreement. The Fraternal Order of Police challenges the 2013 termination in arbitration. The arbitrator finds that the 2007 Last Chance Agreement wasn't valid. Why? Because the FOP wasn't a party to it. Remember that yellow dog contract thing? And so the arbitrator reinstates Olson, but the arbitrator is really concerned. He makes a finding that Olson has a tendency to be abrupt or dismissive towards his coworkers, that he had issues taking direction, and that he far too often displayed poor judgment and discretion in carrying out his police duties. So what the arbitrator decides to do is to impose a new last chance agreement. And under the last chance agreement, which upon which Olson's reinstatement is conditioned, under the new last chance agreement, Olson has to participate in training to address his deficiencies and performance issues. He has to refrain from engaging in similar misconduct within 3 years after his reinstatement. And the arbitrator eventually provides, this is through a clarification of his opinion, that if Olson did engage in misconduct or performance issues, that conduct was sufficient cause for termination, period, end of issue. And the only question to be decided by an arbitrator, should he engage in this future misconduct, was whether Olson engaged in the conduct. And if the village was able to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he engaged in the misconduct, end of issue, termination upheld. So how does Olson fare after being placed on this new last chance agreement, which he signed as a result of the 2013 termination? How does he fare? Well, he lasts only a matter of weeks. And in the course of those weeks, Olson racks up really a career's worth, a very impressive number of violations. They include his failure to report for a fitness for duty evaluation. And this failure to report stems from a fitness for duty evaluation that actually his union, the FOP, had requested. And the village ends up agreeing to it and tries to send Olson for the evaluation. The village isn't able to get in touch with Olson. He's not answering the phone or anything like that. So the police chief drives to his home and tapes the report for the examination order on the front of Olson's door. Olson doesn't answer the police chief's ringing the doorbell and knocking the door. The next day, Olson does get in touch with the chief and says, I received the order, but I can't attend the examination because I'm sick with the flu. And Olson then asks, look, if I'm going to have to go through a third-party evaluation, I want to know a couple of things. I want to know, are you going to put me up in a hotel when I have to go through this evaluation? And also, are you going to pay me overtime? And eventually, Olson simply refuses to comply with the order to participate in the fitness for duty evaluation. The village says enough is enough, fires him, and the case once again goes to arbitration. And the only question for the arbitrator is whether or not Olson engaged in any misconduct. And the arbitrator says he engaged in a lot that triggered the last chance agreement. He failed to back up a fellow officer on a traffic stop. With regard to the fitness for duty evaluation, I'm completely unconvinced by his testimony. I don't think he was sick with the flu to begin with. He initially had the story that he didn't have transportation to the examination site. And when that problem was solved, That's when he got sick with the flu. Really, I'm just not buying his story about the fitness for duty evaluation. And it also doesn't make sense to me that a person who's too ill to go to an examination would consider going if the employer paid them overtime and gave them hotel accommodations. So I find Olson engaged in misconduct. I don't even need to think about the penalty. The penalty is specified in the last chance agreement. Termination upheld. So what are the takeaways from this complicated case involving Officer Olson? Complicated factually. I think there's two. The first is the one that I started with, which is last chance agreements do have to have the union on board as a signatory. And secondly, if there is a valid last chance agreement, it means what it says. It's a contract. And if the employee engages in any misconduct that triggers the last chance agreement, an arbitrator is going to uphold termination. Arbitrator is not going to be thinking about mitigating circumstances or the employee's work record or progressive discipline or disparate treatment or any of those other elements of just cause. The arbitrator is simply going to uphold the terms of that last chance contract. The last case I want to talk about today is a bargaining case. It's a firefighter case involving subcontracting. But before I get into the case, which is out of New York, I want to talk kind of broadly about issues that are going on concerning the area of subcontracting. One of the points that has been made repeatedly by some of the Koch brothers funded institutions, Americans for Prosperity and the like, is that we ought to be looking at the consolidation of public employee responsibilities, not just consolidation, but privatization as well. And that is seeming to get some traction around the country. There's not huge elements of it, but there is some of it. First of all, with respect to privatization, you are seeing, I think, a renewed push to privatize ambulance services around the country. Also, we have seen privatization of correctional functions in various places. One of the most profitable companies in the United States is the Corrections Corporation of America. And it seems very clear, I shouldn't say very clear, early indications are from the Trump administration that it intends to vastly increase the number of private prisons in this country. So we're seeing privatization both in law enforcement and in the fire service. At the same time, we're seeing consolidation. We're seeing consolidation of fire departments into fire districts. We are seeing fire departments, individual city fire departments taken over by county fire departments. And we are also seeing on the law enforcement side, cities basically getting out of the business of having police departments and turning law enforcement responsibilities over to the county or in some cases to the state. With respect to that last development, usually you see a contract where a city agrees to pay X dollars per month or per hour or per whatever to a county, and the county provides deputies who will do the normal patrol responsibilities that city police used to do. And in some cases, you just see the cities simply going out of business and hoping that the state police will take over. That has happened in a number of states. It's a big issue right now in Pennsylvania, where the state police are saying, or the state government is saying, look, you can't simply do that and not pay us anything, because then, in essence, all of the state is subsidizing your decision not to have a police department, and that's not fair. My point through all of this is just simply that there is a swirl of developments around this issue of what I think of broadly as subcontracting. And for now, we all have a definition of subcontracting in our minds. For now, erase that definition of subcontracting. And let me give you the labor relations definition of subcontracting. The labor relations definition of subcontracting is the transfer of work that either is currently or logically would be performed by members of the bargaining unit. And subcontracting can mean, for example, the hiring of the ABC ambulance service by a city. That's a form of subcontracting. It may mean assigning work to unpaid volunteers, like a reserve police force. That's subcontracting. It may be the assignment of bargaining unit work to non-bargaining unit personnel. Having, for example, lieutenants and captains in a police department doing roll call, where roll call had been handled by bargaining unit sergeants in the past. Subcontracting typically is a mandatory subject of bargaining, meaning the employer can't unilaterally do it. The rules vary a bit from state to state, but that's the general proposition, that the decision to subcontract is a mandatory subject of bargaining. Even in those states where subcontracting isn't mandatory for bargaining, subcontracting is thought to have mandatorily negotiable impacts on bargaining. What might you want to bargain about over impacts? You might want to bargain over the workload for the remaining employees. You might want to bargain over anything to do that might have safety implications as a result of the subcontracting. Now, what about where the subcontracting results in layoffs? Well, typically, an employer's decision to lay off employees, the decision is not mandatory for bargaining, but there may well be mandatorily negotiable impacts, which have to be bargained before the decision is implemented. How long is someone going to be on the layoff list? How long will they be able to receive some form of salary or health insurance or salary supplement, or whatever it might be? And of course, if there are large-scale layoffs, there may well be safety impacts for those who are left that have to be bargained. Well, it's that swirl of events, that swirl of labor relations considerations that comes out of this recent case decided by a New York Public Employment Relations Board administrative law judge involving the city of Lockport, New York. The city's firefighters were represented by Local 963 of the IAFF. The firefighters were cross-trained in firefighting and providing EMS services. And at least prior to 2014, each firefighter was assigned to both an ambulance and a fire vehicle. Since 1979, so a long time, firefighters have provided EMS and ambulance services in the city and generally had responded with an ambulance to every fire, car accident, or EMS call. In 2011, the parties finally get around to negotiating a successor to their contract. Their contract, last contract, it started in 2008. Local 963 was optimistic. They wanted to restore minimum manning from 9 to 10 and have some modifications in work schedules and improvements in health care benefits. However, the mayor at the time, a guy named Michael Tucker, said, look, we're in dire financial situation here. He's proposing the elimination of all minimum manning standards and is offering a retirement incentive, but only if the union withdraws all of its pending grievances. Abruptly, in January of 2014, Mayor Tucker ends negotiations and the city simply abolishes 8 firefighter positions, which results in 7 layoffs. Local 963 demands impact bargaining, and the parties seem to be headed in that direction. However, Mayor Tucker himself then resigns, and you've got the president of the city council, someone named Ann McCaffrey, who assumes responsibilities as mayor. Mayor McCaffrey tells Local 963, look, I need time to assess the financial situation before I can continue bargaining, but eventually the city does something else unilateral. It simply surrenders its ambulance operating certificate and takes the department's ambulances out of service. That's done in September 2014. So this is all within a year of when the two sides sit down to start bargaining. The city enters into an agreement with a local company, Twin City Ambulance Corporation, to provide ambulance services. The city doesn't actually pay the corporation any money, but it assigns to the corporation the right to collect Medicaid and other payments for ambulance services. And the city cuts staffing again from 38 to 33 firefighters, lays off five more firefighters, and unilaterally reduces minimum manning to six. What's this produce from Local 963? Let's all see if we can say the phrase together. An unfair labor practice complaint, alleging that the city failed to engage in bargaining over the layoffs and the contract with the corporation, and that it failed to bargain in good faith. And the administrative law judge, I think, lays out the law here quite correctly as to what has to happen in this sort of situation. The ALJ says, first of all, city's right. Doesn't have an obligation to bargain over the managerial decision to reduce staffing. It can lay off employees. It has that right to make that decision. But it does have to bargain over the impact of the layoffs on employees. And here the city was on notice that the local wanted to bargain, had demanded to bargain. And the fact that the local didn't follow up immediately on that due to the abrupt change in the mayor's office and the city's financial position doesn't relieve the city of the obligation to bargain. The city next says, look, we don't have anything we have to bargain over here because, you know, we're not paying the corporation anything. And the administrative law judge says, au contraire. You do have an obligation to bargain because you have retained significant control over ambulance services. That contract with the corporation contains things like staffing requirements, what an ambulance has to look like, what type of equipment it has on it, the response time, and all of those factors. You have control over these ambulance services, albeit it's just an oversight role, and that means that you've, in essence, you're still engaged in the business of overseeing ambulance services. Therefore, there is an obligation on your part to engage in impact bargaining. So here's the bottom line from the ALJ. And I'm going to quote a couple sentences here. Although there is no transfer of funds between the city and the corporation, that fact is not controlling. The corporation receives payments for its services from Medicare, Medicaid, and other third-party insurers or from patients in the same manner in which the city received compensation from those parties for those services. By assigning the exclusive right of the corporation to provide ambulance services for city residents and to bill for that service, it has transferred the work at issue to a private entity in breach of its bargaining obligation. What's the remedy? Get ready. The administrative law judge ordered the city to restore the employees to the employees of the local the work of providing ambulance services, and to make them whole for any wages and benefits lost as a result of the transfer, together with interest at the currently prevailing maximum legal rate. And that, by the way, is the typical remedy in these subcontracting cases. And that is, you pay the members of the bargaining unit for the work they would have performed had you not transferred the work in derogation of your bargaining obligations. Now, one little footnote here that I want to suggest that everybody think about. Oregon is one of very few states that has a statute that deals with the transfer of work from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Wouldn't have helped the Lockport firefighters where you had privatization, but it would help city police officers where the city contracts with a sheriff's department or local fire departments that get consolidated into a fire district. What's the Oregon statute say? The Oregon statute says that when the functions of one governmental body are transferred to another, the transferee governmental body has to hire the employees from the organization that's doing the transferring and has to maintain their wages and benefits at no less than the level they received prior to the transfer. As I say, some states do have that sort of statute. If you're interested, just send us an email and we'll send you a copy of the Oregon statute. Well, that's it for March 2017. Thanks for joining us in the podcast. We hope to see you in Las Vegas in April for LRIS's seminar on collective bargaining for public safety employees. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.